Well, second presentation. Welcome, everybody. Again, I see some here who have been here this morning, some who I've met at previous presentations. It's a pleasure to be here again in Camrose for the second presentation, which in a way continues where we left off this morning. This morning was about who was Jesus and did what Jesus did. So the mission of Jesus, did that somehow lead to the death? Is there any connection? Because it is the prevailing perception that Jesus was just some kind of sinless person, so he could not never have possibly been in any conflict with the religious or political authorities of his time. And I wanted to show that Jesus was a bit different. He was not quite as mild-mannered as we thought. Well, the resistance he thought about happened to be non-violent. But besides that, Jesus was certainly nobody who was just be willing to pass things and to tolerate the status quo. He was somebody who was keenly aware of the oppression at his time. So that means the oppression of his Judean brothers and sisters, how they suffered from Roman oppression. On the other hand, also aware of the fact that the very religious system that had developed favored some and disfavored others, and actually almost criminalized them in a particular way, stigmatized them so that then disease and physical handicap became an indication of also religious disqualification. And Jesus went ahead and shared, announced a kingdom of God that was open to all of these people, and announced an inclusive vision of the kingdom of God. Now, I also concluded you can do that, but with this challenge, you have to be ready that there are some consequences. And as I just said, you know, it could have been crucifixion. It could have been the same fate that John the Baptizer suffered. But that in and of itself doesn't really mean that this has a particular salvific effect for us today. So why are we celebrating this? Well, today still people turn to Jesus as a model for nonviolent resistance, but does this have any value for us as people who have faith, who are Christians, who believe that this has something to do with our personal lives and how is this communicated to us? Is Jesus only somebody for political activists? And then maybe what about the 90% here, dare I say 98%, who are not political activists? And I think that's a different way of phrasing what this presentation is all about. Yes, he has something to do. It doesn't mean that not everybody could think about, you know, political activism being a legitimate venue for Christians, but that was also just one aspect of who Jesus was. And there's more to the mission of Jesus. By the way, can you hear me well? I should ask that rather at the beginning of the presentation. Okay. Once again, we'll also reflect on our church season. We're at this point meditating on and commemorating the death and the resurrection of Jesus. And so what exactly then do these events have to do with us and how are they being communicated to us? The outline of this afternoon's presentation is roughly this here. Well, first of all, here's the title, Celebrating Salvation. What is the power of the Eucharist or of the Last Supper? And there are several ways of calling this. Celebrating Salvation, the structure of this will be that we study what blood rituals are in the Old Testament. Then we will study blood rituals at the Second Temple of Jerusalem, understand from there what the cup of the covenant actually means, and then also go into the piece, the bread, which is the body. So we'll actually look at the two elements of the Eucharist. Remember me, it says here There are different ways also of looking at the Eucharist. The Eucharist is a ritual which is at the heart of the Christian Church, but it is not a big theological talk. It is not a book read to a community. It is a set of peculiar actions. That means there are things which are done, gestures. There's also stuff being said about it. So these gestures, these elements are accompanied by explanations. But it also means that there's an openness to interpretation. And that openness to interpretation really then depends on who we are and where we come from. And so we see here a lot of different interpretations, a lot of different artists saying, okay, for me the Eucharist is this. And actually, I think all of them are interesting. All of them have their own value. I wouldn't say, well, you know, this is maybe wrong. Okay, but the next one here, okay, that's right here. Maybe because one showed African people and this one showed more European people. It just shows probably that the artist giving this this visual impression of the Eucharist comes from a particular background, and that's what it's all about. That means who we are is somehow important. Speaking of which, I said this, or I shouldn't say this morning, it was at noon, I said, I'm a Lutheran, but I'm a converted Lutheran. I started out as a Roman Catholic. Just curious, are there many more Lutherans here? Maybe you can... Oh, la la. Okay. Seems that the Lutherans are in the majority. Who else could we think about? Well, Roman Catholics. Are there any Catholics here? One, two. Let's see. Methodists. Anglicans. One. Mennonites. Okay, no Mennonites. Pentecostals. One, two. Okay, so we see that we're actually a very diverse group here. Even though the Lutherans are in the majority, but we'll try to be as tolerant as we can, right? We're all in the best of our behavior today. By the way, that one's funny here. So, so, and I'm asking you a real question here. How do you call this thing? So I think, you know, we all agree there is somehow a piece of bread there and a cup with... But then we're not even sure what's in the cup, right? Is it wine or is it juice? In my service, I'm never quite sure whether I'm supposed to go right or left after the bread, because I always know one of them is grape juice, but I would rather go for the wine, but I never know exactly whether that's right or left. So what we're, you know, sure about the cup and the bread, but how do you call this? I had two titles there. Okay, Eucharist, is that common for who here? That's, huh? Holy Communion, I hear. Okay, Holy Communion and Eucharist, and what else? How else do you call that? Lord's Supper. Uh-huh. The meal, that's very general. Okay, by the way, Lord's Supper then sounds quite similar to Last Supper, right? I mean, I'm more familiar, so coming from Germany, to Last Supper, or at least what in German is Last Supper. And actually, it's Last Supper, it's Abendmahl, so it's actually evening meal. That's would have been the most traditional name for this from my German background, but I've never heard that anywhere else here. Last Supper refers to exactly the Holy Week, which means that Easter is approaching, and it was the last meal of Jesus. Lord's Supper is simply reflecting on the authority of the one who did it, quite clearly. Oh. If you want some funny and nice teaching tools, the Brick Testament is it called, I think. You have all the Gospels played and actually nice little images of brick or Lego figures. Any other label for the same ritual? I think I still had the Sacrament of the Lord's Table. Is that known to somebody? I see a few here. Okay. So we see already that we have pretty much half a dozen different labels for one and the same ritual. I guess we are then more readily agreeing on its form on the one end, and also on the fact that it's somehow quite central to what we're doing in the Christian Church. So at least in my congregation, we're centering, or the two main elements are the sermon on the one hand, and on the other hand, the sacrament, and the main sacrament then is the Eucharist, or the Last Supper. I said already that it is somehow ritual. And ritual always means they are peculiar elements. They are things being done. So the pastor or priest will raise up a piece of bread. Will usually, in order to make a little bit more drama, will try to break the bread, as he says, or today she says some of the words. It's also about a cup being raised, about the neat arrangement of things on the altar. It is, by the way, also about us, right? It is a ritual where we, now I have to be careful already, usually go to the altar, to up front. Who does it differently here? Is there anybody who has the Eucharist being passed through the ranks? And I know that that exists as well. So we see that already with regard to this element, how we are involved. The Christian church doesn't have the one normative element or one normative ritual. So that's why there are different ways of doing it, and there isn't really any particularly wrong explanation of it or wrong interpretation of it. However, I'm a professor of biblical studies, and so I'm looking at the Bible, and it is actually my profession to share with people what, for instance, Jesus said about these things. So there is an open ritual, but there are some things which Jesus said about this ritual. And I'll try to help us gain to perhaps a new interpretation or a sense of what Jesus has been saying about that ritual that he instituted. At this point, I actually have to stop this and go into the next one. Check. So we'll, I ran out of space here. I was trying to cram in all the different designations, but I left it with Eucharist and Last Supper. So I ask for forgiveness of those who know it under a different title, but we're all talking about this one and the same ritual. I want to start with the basics, and for me that's the biblical text, and there are a few of them in the Bible, in the New Testament. This is probably one of the oldest ones. Now scholars debate whether this here is a bit older than the version in 1 Corinthians, and we'll come to this in a minute. This is from the Gospel according to Mark. That means it was written down, not transmitted, but written down roughly between 65 and maybe 72, during that 6 or 7 year period. And at that time, Mark wrote what? While they all were eating, he took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, gave it to them, and said, "Take, this is my body." Then he, now that's all Jesus, took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, and all of them drank from it. And Jesus said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly, I tell you, I will never again drink of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." This is the version of Mark. It should sound somewhat familiar because that's roughly where our church liturgy comes from. But maybe you also realize that there are a few things which aren't quite exactly how the church liturgy goes and how our pastors are doing the Eucharist. Now, what are some of the differences? Well, first of all, actually, where are the differences? There are other stories about other versions of the Eucharist in Matthew chapter 26, in Luke 22, and then, as I said, in 1 Corinthians, so that's a letter written by Paul. And Paul was definitely written earlier than the Gospel according to Mark. Why did I still say that maybe Mark is an earlier version than 1 Corinthians? It's because whatever Mark wrote down roughly around 70 has been around for quite some time, and it was communicated orally. So people would come and would tell the story over and over again, and they didn't get tired of telling it over again. So the story had been there, despite the fact that it was written down a bit later in 70. So that's why it might actually still predate, which might be written earlier than 1 Corinthians, which is sometime in the mid-50s. So there are these texts, and then I should, by the way, also say John 6, which we'll also study in a moment, which inform us about the Eucharist. Now, are they all the same? No, they are not. I'll walk you quickly through some of the differences. Luke does something very strange. If here the order is bread is body, and then cup is blood, Luke starts with the cup and then has the bread and then resumes with the cup. By the way, blessing and giving thanks is only there in Matthew and Mark. Luke and 1 Corinthians only has the giving thanks. Mark only has take. Take, eat is only there in Matthew. As you see, there are just minor detail changes. By the way, drink from it, all of you, is only in Matthew. It's not in here. Now, more significantly, I wanted to show you this one here. For the forgiveness of sins, in the four texts, it is only to be found in Matthew. Maybe even more important, at least I find that, is the next one here, that it's a new covenant, is only in Luke and in 1 Corinthians 11. So, you know, sometimes it's actually doing scholarship is just a question of drawing things out in a table. If you would have a table with four columns, you'd discover those differences quite easily. Today's computer software makes it quite simple. Sometimes you just hit a button, and then you have all these texts displayed next to each other. That can be a helpful tool. Somehow, all of this then has been condensed by the church. So the church is aware of all these differences and yet has tried to narrow down to one version of the Eucharist liturgy. And that's what we're celebrating today. So the church is aware of this. In the gospel setting, the Eucharist is actually introduced, first of all, by language that is traditional. And it's not called the Eucharist. Jesus is getting ready for the last day, and he asks his disciples to celebrate a Passover, because that's the reason why he came to Jerusalem. So what we'll do is we'll actually study for a moment the Passover of the Judeans. What did a regular Passover actually look like? And then we'll also reflect on the purpose of the Passover. I just walk you through some of the elements. Sorry for the many elements in this presentation here, but it might be quite instructive. So the Judean Passover consisted in the first place of people just gathering. You'd gather families and friends in groups of at least 10 in number. Then second, the host gives thanks for the feast day and for the first of four cups of wine, which he then serves to his guests. The first course contains hors d'oeuvre, greens, bitter herbs, and a particular sauce, which is a mixture of fruit and vinegar, and that is served and is all eaten. Number four, the Haggadah is told. What is the Haggadah? It is the Passover story. It focuses on three elements. The Passover, when God passed over, quite literally, the houses in Egypt. Of course, the houses of the Israelites. And then the whole story of the unleavened bread that represents the fathers being redeemed from Egypt, and the bitter herbs that signified how the Egyptians embittered the lives of their fathers in Egypt. And the first part of the Hallel cycle is sung, so those are psalms. Number five, the second course, it begins with the drinking of the second cup of wine. The host says grace over the unleavened bread, and that is now served for the first time in the meal. The main dish is roasted lamb, the Passover lamb, with bitter herbs and fruit puree. Now, the third cup of wine, known as the cup of blessing, again a prayer of thanksgiving is said. Number seven, the second part of the Hallel is sung, that is Psalm 115, or if you have lots of time, 114 through 118. Then, you need to be in good spirit for that. You drink the fourth cup of wine. Even though some have raised doubts whether that was already in practice at the time of Jesus. After the meal, number nine, there was prayer, not just short, but the guests would spend the night soberly in prayer. When I read this, I was wondering, soberly, really, after four cups of wine. Anyway. It's maybe stated for a good cause here. So, this is a ritual, but we see that it's an important piece in Jewish religion, but it's all around a meal. So we already get a sense that a meal has a significance for people. It's not just about, you know, I'm hungry, I need to get full, but there is some specific meaning behind it. And what is the meaning behind it? The purpose is remembering not anything, but the Exodus from Egypt. And that means the liberation of Israel, the time when Israel could finally get into the promised land, the liberation from oppressive forces. With regard to that, we actually see that that was, and we can assume now that that was a time when the Roman dominators were always a bit uneasy. Okay, now the people which they are suppressing is reflecting on this time when they gain national authority, and might that have ramifications for exactly the political stability of our days. So Passover was not just some kind of church celebration and nobody cared about it. I can tell you that the political authorities looked very closely. They would probably have done what happened just these days in Tibet. They would have sent the troops out, you know, just to stand there and watch a bit closer and make sure that nothing unusual happens. You know, just be a bit more suspicious about people. Make sure that people know that you are there. And that if something goes wrong, you can use violence once more. Passover was not just any neutral time. It was a time when the Judeans gathered, they all came to Jerusalem, and they would develop national and religious sentiments. Should we try to compare it again to something today? Well, it might not hurt. Maybe it's something like Independence Day. Isn't that when people, at least in the U.S., celebrate independence from... Actually, I'm, I guess, too short in North America, but what is it, some kind of battle between or political treaty between U.S. and America that was just then formed and the British Empire? What's Independence Day all about? I should know that probably. Nobody else here knows it. I'm pleased. Okay, maybe is there something equivalent in Canadian history or Canadian society? What's kind of the big national day here? It's not Family Day, is it? Any Canada Day? What's Canada Day about? Canada is a nation. So perhaps, yeah. Of course, once again, we're not doing this in the face of still an oppressive force, right? I mean, we are now the dominant society and dominant culture, and we're celebrating that that happened at some point. Maybe at that point treaties were signed, but that's, you know, a little bit parallel to celebrating Passover 2,000 years ago in that little province of Judea. So there was always a bit of a smell of revolution in the air. Now, this was the setting Jesus chose. And if you remember this morning's presentation, which I tried to summarize a little bit, I think there is a connection here. Jesus knew why he chose that particular event for going and coming to Jerusalem. Now, to understand how Jesus imagined and what was Jesus' interpretation of this ritual, I want to walk you through some of the things which Jesus says. We have seen that already in the text of Mark 14. I wanted to study with the blood of the covenant. Blood of the covenant, I guess you've heard it quite often, but what exactly does that mean? We don't really do covenants today, right? I hear the United Church, they covenant sometimes. That means they make agreements. But we Lutherans don't. I think all the other denominations don't really do covenants. So we have to actually do a little bit of footwork to recover what is meant by a covenant. The problem is that Jesus himself did not explain what that means. He just used the term. What does that mean? Well, Jesus could just use it because everybody knew what that meant. I'll give you another example. If today you say Halloween, everybody knows what Halloween is all about, right? Well, you've all celebrated it. You hear Halloween. You see in your mind pumpkins with candles in the air. You maybe smell candy, or you think about dressing up in a funky way, and all these things. Maybe you think about movies, which are a bit scary. That's Halloween. Now try to imagine that, I don't know what, a meteor just hits North America, we all get wiped out, and then archaeologists in 1,000 years find maybe a candy wrapper and says Halloween on it. Now exactly what does this archaeologist in a thousand years do with this, you know, Halloween, okay, how do we actually find out about this? Huh. Well, maybe try to find some old DVDs with a Halloween movie of, you know, which was produced these days, but we have to do something. Preferably time travel, right? We'd have to time travel, try to come back to this time where we're today in order to find out about Halloween. By the way, the same thing applies to Christmas. Easter, you know, why the eggs? But whenever we hear Easter egg, all sorts of associations come alive for us. I'm saying that because covenant at the time of Jesus still had a meaning. Atonement still had a meaning. These are all terms which meant a hell lot to people. And why? Because the institution where these things were done, the temple, was still there. It was destroyed 40 years after the death of Jesus. So by the time Jesus walked around, the temple was under construction, the worship went on, and people would have known about, well, a covenant and blood rituals. They would have known about the sacrificial cult, which was executed at or done at the temple. Well, we don't anymore, and that's why we have to do some work to try to understand what's exactly going on back then, and then this will help us to understand the blood of the covenant. We have already looked a little bit at the temple in the previous presentation. I think I put this slide in here again. Okay, it's a bit shorter this time, so here's again our pilgrim. And it's now all about this particular temple here. That's where sacrifices were offered. So whenever somebody would try to worship God, that person would have to bring a sacrifice on the altar, which we just see there in the forecourt. This golden... Actually, no, that's the laver. That's where people would have washed their hands. But we'll see it in a minute. So in that forecourt, people would bring their sacrifices. We'll close in. Close up. Here we come. This is the altar now. You bring those sacrifices. There was lots of fire, lots of smoke rising to heaven. Here's a priest carrying a lamb up the ramp to the main altar in front of the temple. See, that's unusual, right? Have you ever done this in your church service? Things do change, and if you haven't done that, you don't know exactly actually what a sacrifice is all about. I'm saying that because I wrote my doctoral dissertation on exactly this piece. It's a big book, and so you can recover lost things from the Bible. So a piece in that doctorate is also about blood rituals. So the blood of these sacrificial animals would be brought into the inner of the temple, and you've seen that in the previous thing already, the priest would sprinkle it to certain places of the temple. For instance, at the curtain separating the holy from the holy of holies. So this is this curtain, and the holy of holies is just behind it, and that means God is residing in that area. So what's the purpose of this? Well, it looks unusual. If we today sprinkle blood, we usually understand this, you know, then it's dirty. Sometimes the air is dry, I get a nosebleed, and then I have a stain on my shirt. You know, I take it off and put it into the washing machine. But things were understood a bit differently back then. And what this means is something I invite you to study at this point. And I therefore have this handout here. So if you want to look at the one page which says blood application in the Hebrew Bible and Old Testament, or Old Testament, you have the relevant texts gathered there. Let's start with the first text, which is in Exodus 24. This is actually not at the temple, but it has to do with the presence of God. If I said God, for the Judeans, lived just behind that curtain, in Exodus 24, God is on Mount Sinai. So let's remember that Passover happened, the people of Israel come out of Egypt, and they're kind of stopping at that Mount Sinai. Now, what happens there is that nobody is supposed to touch the mountain, not even put a foot to it. Why? Because everybody is considered to be sinful. The text even says, even the priests could not do this because even the priests were too sinful. The text is interesting because by that time there weren't any priests ordained. So why exactly that was in there, you see that a later person kind of inserted this and wanted to make the point. So Israel, the entire people, is at the foot of this mountain. Now what do they do? They worship God because God is at the mountain, and they offer sacrifices. And that means they would have taken some of the blood, and now the text of Exodus 24 says what Moses does with this blood. He takes half of it and sprinkles it on the people. Okay. It doesn't say why he does it, he just says he does it. And what is now important is that this blood is called the blood of the covenant. And that's what you have in this first passage here. Exodus 24, Moses took the blood and dashed it on the people and said, see, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. The blood of the covenant. You know what? If Jesus, many centuries later, says this is the cup of the covenant or the blood of the covenant, he is referring to this. He is quoting Exodus 24, verse 8. We still don't exactly know why this was done in Exodus 24. We just know now that it happened. So Moses dashes the blood on the people. By the way, there was a second component. Moses also read a book. And that was a book full of commandments that God had dictated to Moses at that time. And Moses reads it to the people and says, this is now the book of the covenant. A book of the covenant. So we have two things of the covenant. We have the blood of the covenant, and we have, number two, the book of the covenant. And everybody of Israel says, we have heard everything now, and we obey to do all of this. So the covenant consists of obedience on the one part. But this blood sprinkling, what was that about? Well, I tell you what happened afterwards. I ask you a question first. Can somebody see God in the Old Testament? Can you see God in the Old Testament? And if not, or if so, where is it in the Old Testament? Because John 1, okay, the first chapter of John says nobody's ever seen God. Okay? In fact, that's not right. What happens after the book of the covenant and the blood of the covenant is that 70 representatives of Israel, now picture this, go up the mountain, and wasn't there God on the mountain? Yes. And the Old Testament text will state explicitly, and they see God. And the text will also say, and God does not kill them. Why? Because that's naturally what God would have needed to do. Humans cannot see God. Why? Because humans are sinful. But the 70 representatives, including Moses and Aaron, could go on the mountain, and they saw God. Gee, God, you haven't really shaved today. You're wearing this long beard there, you know, but we can see you. And you know what? And they had a meal there. They ate, and they drank, and they had a good time. Why is this important? Because this tells us what the blood sprinkling did before. It cleansed the people of their sins and impurities. Humans, as I said, could not touch the mountain before because they were sinful. And after they said, we will do everything that is written in this book of the covenant, and after they were sprinkled with the blood of the covenant, they were pure. They could go up the mountain and they could see God and they could have a good time, a rolling good time in the presence of God. Do you know what? This is so spectacular that it had to be changed. I'm having here the Hebrew Old Testament, okay, or the Hebrew Bible. There is a translation out of this, the Greek translation that was actually current at the time of Jesus. Jesus would have had, the Bible of Jesus would have been Greek, and that's the Septuagint. This thing that that Israel could see God was such a challenge to the translators of this year into Greek, that they changed the text. So in the Septuagint, this Greek translation, the same verse reads that the Israelites could just see the place where God stood. There's no sense anymore of what the Hebrew text says is actually that the Israelites could see God. By the way, that's the reason why then John 1 says that nobody ever has seen God. Because at the time of Christianity, the Bible was the Septuagint and not the Hebrew Bible. So you see actually things fit together, but you need to know that this was such a challenge at 300 or 200 before Christ, that the translator of the Septuagint just couldn't believe they read this, and so they changed it. Just a little observation here. So an amazing thing happened. People can get rid of their sins by being applied with blood. This is just one text. I compiled a whole list for you here because I think it is interesting to realize that blood application, that means, you know, the blood is sprinkled or smeared on something, that happens all the time in the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament. Is Matt still here? Matt Leising? Hi. He's one of my students here from Saskatoon. I mean, no longer because we kicked him out. No, we didn't really kick him out. Well, he graduated a year ago. I was on the examining committee here for Alberta. And he is now a pastor. Where are you, Matt? Huh? In Edmonton, Augustana. Okay. Nice to see you again, Matt. So he was ordained as a minister. Just wondering, you know, how did this ordination thing work all out? What did they do? Did they ever put some hands on you or... No blood. Oh, that's too bad. You know, it's much more fun, but okay. Well, you know, somebody like Matt would have been ordained in a different fashion in the Old Testament, and you can read it in the next passage, which I compiled for you. In Exodus 29 and Leviticus 8, you have texts which maybe you never paid too much attention to, but it actually says that a priest is ordained by actually consecration. Consecration means that person is made holy, okay? Made holy means before that person wasn't holy and afterwards that person is holy. And it happens by putting blood on them. So they would take sacrificial blood like here and wouldn't put it on the curtain, but would put it on the lobe of their ears and on their thumbs and on their big toes. Sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? But that's how it worked. And once again, afterwards, these people were holy. What does it mean that they are holy? Well, what does a priest do? It means that they can approach God. They can come 3 inches close to God. That's what consecration or holiness means. And now we're finally getting back to this scenery here. I put you on a hold a little bit here with the text in Leviticus 16. Once again, a strange text. even though that's still the text which is operative for the Jewish community, because that's the text, Leviticus 18, in at the Day of Atonement, the Yom HaKippurim. Yom HaKippurim in the Hebrew Bible, today it's Yom Kippur. I'll read that passage here for you because it just explains what you see on the slide here. Then he, now that's Aaron, the high priest, shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement on its behalf. And he shall take some of the blood of the bull and of the blood of the goat, so those were sacrificed before, and put it on each of the horns of the altar. So there were four horns in each corner. He shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger seven times and cleanse it, and it's called here hallowed. We could also say consecrated, kidesh in Hebrew. So he consecrates it from the uncleanness of the people of Israel. Okay, one thing is maybe already getting clear here. You see here that putting blood on something, establishing physical contact, purifies this thing. Something which I need to mention, though, is the last words here. He purified it or cleansed it from the uncleanness of the people of Israel. Huh? Well, that's something which we've totally lost today. We know about sin, and we know about personal sin. So, you know, I do something wrong. I park my car at a spot where I'm not supposed to park it. And we have a sense, okay, that's somehow sin, which, you know, is which I carry. Whether I'm deeply burdened by it is another question, but that's still something which we do remember. What we have lost a sense of today is that in the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, sin always had a further ramification, a further consequence. And that is, every sin polluted the sanctuary, that thing which you saw there. The second temple was polluted by human impurity and sin. And that's why it had to be purified on a regular basis. And that's actually the main objective and the main purpose of the Day of Atonement on Leviticus in Leviticus 16. So human sins pollute this, and it has to be cleansed. And the only way of doing this is taking the blood of sacrificial animals and applying it to the various parts of it we see here in the sanctuary and then outside and on the altar and on priests to consecrate them. How does this work? Well, here's one more text. Leviticus 17 does biblical scholars a great favor because it's very rare that we get explanations like this. But here, in this particular verse, we have one such explanation. Oh, by the way, I should click my slides here. Okay, here we go. And 17. Here we go. So Israel has been consecrated through the physical contact with blood, and the rationale how this works is provided in Leviticus 17:11. You have it on the handout. The text says, "For the life of the flesh, or every flesh, is in the blood. And I," that means God, "have given it to you," the humans, "for making atonement for your lives on the altar. For, as life, or through life, blood makes atonement." So we hear here that it is the life force in the blood that produces atonement. And I think actually we can understand this. If sin is maybe a representative of death, of human fallenness, then it can be purified by a representative of life. And obviously, blood in the cult of the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, is understood to be this representative of life. So actually, all of these things, they happen through life. So what does this all now do for us as we're studying the Eucharist, or the Last Supper, and the words, the blood of the covenant? Or, to put it differently, when Jesus did this and said, "This is the cup of the covenant," or of the new covenant, what did he have in mind? Well, Jesus had in mind this very mechanism I just tried to outline, a mechanism that we usually are not aware of, but a mechanism very well known at the time of Jesus, because it happened every year, at least once a year, at the Day of Atonement, that blood would be sprinkled all over the sanctuary, and it was understood to purify it. Now that means Jesus understands the drinking of the cup in exactly the same fashion. The drinking of the cup cleanses upon physical contact. Okay, it's just a purifying agent as the blood in the Old Testament. That's why it is important to drink the cup. That's what Jesus suggests. Just looking at it and saying, okay, this is a cup, and then putting it away doesn't really do at that point. Just the way the blood had to be sprinkled on the curtain, as we saw, as it had to be sprinkled on the people of Israel at Mount Sinai, as it had to be smeared onto the lobe of the ear of the priests, as it has to always be put into physical contact, this is just the way, the same way we have to become, have to get into physical contact with the blood of Jesus, and that is represented through the wine. What is then the power of this? What does it mean to us? It means we can do the same thing the priest can do. If the priest could move into immediate proximity of God, we can do the same. Have you ever wondered why during the Eucharist you're actually approaching the altar of the church? This is a chapel. It is a worship place. And there are lesser holy places and more holy places, right? Somehow, usually, I mean, there would be, if we imagine this was a church, there would be a cross here in a Catholic church. No, there would be the tabernacle here with the elements, okay, the consecrated blood, wine and the bread. And so this is where usually the priest is operating, doing his business. And it's at this point that the congregation may draw as closely as ever to the realm where God is understood to reside, because the people are getting consecrated. We are being made holy through eating the bread, by drinking the wine. This is actually the power of the cup. This is the covenant that God has instituted. It's a covenant of life for us, which eliminates sin. Now, I'm aware of the fact that there is a second component to the Eucharist, and that's the bread. Oh. Okay, do we get to the bread? The second piece is the bread, and Jesus says, "This is the bread of my body." Now, is this just about something which that Jesus turns himself into, this bread? When I was young, I went to a Roman Catholic church, and that was actually the understanding I gained, that Jesus kind of magically transformed himself into this piece of bread that I was eating then. I held this interpretation for some time. I have since come to revise my opinion, and I want to invite you to look at a different way of looking at things. You see that the cup could only be understood by understanding certain things in the Old Testament. Jesus used language of the Old Testament. In the same way, the bread is something which is intimately linked to the story of the life of Jesus. So actually, about what we did this today forenoon, who is Jesus? Who is he? This is actually conveyed in this very passage here in Mark 8. There's a curious little note in there which follows on the second feeding story in Mark. Yes, the second feeding story, because there's two. There's first the feeding story of the 5,000 and then of the 4,000. And after the second feeding story happens, Mark says that the disciples had forgotten to bring bread. They had only one bread with them in the boat. And the disciples said to one another, "It is because we have no bread." And becoming aware of it, Jesus said to them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not perceive or understand what this is all about?" So Jesus challenges them and tells them there's actually a meaning attached to all this bread business. This is a symbol for something else. If you turn over your handout, you see, you find the passage of Mark 8, and likewise Matthew 16, which is the same story, and it'll actually continue. Jesus says, "How could you fail to perceive that I was not speaking about bread?" Okay, so they're just worried about having physical bread to eat, when Jesus actually meant this in a symbolic way. He wanted them to understand this actually goes much further than just about, you know, being hungry and getting something to eat. Now, actually, where is this going? The bread, which is Jesus' body, is reflected upon by Jesus in another story. And Jesus engages in a discussion with some Judean folks. It's in this story, in this long narrative, in John 6. And Jesus says, "I am the bread of life." You have the passage on the handout again. Jesus says, "This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat from it and may not die. I am the living bread that comes down from heaven. Whoever eats of this bread will live forever." And then verse 52. Now, some Jews amongst themselves disputed and said, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" And then Jesus told them, "Very truly, I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man," and that means of the human person, "and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood have eternal life, and I will raise them up on the last day. For my flesh is the true food, and my blood is true drink." What we see here, though, is that it is not about the very direct thing of eating the body of Jesus. It is about eating Jesus in a different way. It is about meals in general, about sharing the hospitality that Jesus did during his lifetime. This is how all of this is linked to the life of Jesus. Meals for Jesus were one of the key pieces of his mission. When we studied this morning, or at noon, that Jesus was in contact with lots of people, it wasn't just about going to them and talking to them, but it was in the first place about having meals with these people. And I list here a number of passages. There are many more in the Gospels where Jesus has, in fact, meals or accepts to be invited by other people. At this point, we have to understand the Mediterranean society or a culture. It is a culture where a meal is exactly the opposite of a fast food, you know, kind of quick visit. It's not about grabbing a burger for 50 minutes and running off and actually going off to work. I've lived in the Mediterranean culture for 7 years because my wife is French, and so the same culture actually is around in France. A meal usually takes between 2 and 7 hours, okay? And you're actually then being served between 3 and 8 or 9 courses. That's pretty long. That means you spend a lot of time together. Now, people in France, as well as in Palestine, they are quite talkative. That means over something between 2 and 7 hours, they get a lot of talking done. So you really get to know the people who are your hosts. Needless to say, that establishes a strong bond with your host. You're not just going there because you're hungry and you're running away. No, being invited to such a meal means that you have almost a perpetual bond with these people. Okay? Meals in North America aren't really fit to understand this, but this is what it means when Jesus is invited at somebody who is considered a sinner by, you know, the religious authorities at his time. And this means that the bread piece of the Eucharist very consciously reflects on this hospitality or this meal celebration that Jesus did during his lifetime. It then reflects on the fact that Jesus particularly went to people who were outcasts, such as Levi, who was a tax collector, so he was not politically correct, how with the 5,000 we can pretty much be sure that those were in all, you know, just the good folks. There are many other stories, as I said, and they all show that Jesus was reaching out to everybody in the society, and that the vision of Jesus of an inclusive society wasn't just manifest in learned discussions. Certainly Jesus said it too, but it was particularly visible in the meal practice of Jesus. And I think that's why Jesus instituted a meal as kind of his testimony. And that's why the Christian church has a meal as its central celebration. Because in a way, it is supposed to be a celebration of everybody here, and even take us today. You know, we're coming from different denominations, from different walks of life, and yet we can all share a meal and therefore celebrate that we all do belong together. And this is the original force in the Eucharist. You see that these two pieces belong together. One inviting everybody, the other one saying, well, if you drink from this cup, your sins are forgiven. In fact, you are consecrated, which means you're becoming as holy as a priest. You may now come as closely as God as you wish. In fact, you may forever be in the arms of God, because you then are God's children. Both pieces belong together, and that is salvation in a Christian fashion. That is what we celebrate at the heart of our worships, and that's what we celebrate at this time of the church season with Easter, with the death of Jesus and the resurrection that is communicated to us through the Eucharist or Last Supper. Thanks for your attention. I'm done for the moment. And at this point, again, I'll invite your questions. Yes.
Why did the Catholic Church in the past
withhold the wine? Oh, good question. You're asking that to a Lutheran theologian. I know that that was one of the first pieces which the reformers reformed. That one of the first things they said is, actually, you know, the Bible says, and then they said, okay, now our priests have to go out and actually also offer the cup to the lay people. By the way, we should mention for the non-Catholics here that in the Catholic tradition, only the priest gets to drink the cup. Everybody gets to eat the bread, but that's true, and I was attending church as a Roman Catholic, I only got the bread and then had to go back. Why they did it? Oh, you know what? I admit I would make up an answer out of out of the spur of the moment, but I don't know. I always assumed that it was just a matter of being careful about the resources and of maybe preventing that wine gets abused. But whether that's kind of the official opinion or the historical reason behind only giving bread to the people, I don't know. I know that the Lutherans do it because both elements have their own history, okay? Both convey salvation in a different fashion. That's why it's important. The other question is, of course, whether we are always aware of exactly how the salvation is conveyed and what this means. But that's why the Protestant Church is eager to share the Eucharist under both of its forms. There was another question. Yes?
When the blood was put on the horns of the altar,
yeah,
does that seem just as making the altar then pure enough to be used further in the ritual? Or was it in any sense a kind of forgiveness of the sins of all the people? It seems like the sins of all of Israel would have corrupted the altar.
Yeah.
Does that take it away, or is that a different purpose?
First of all, it only then purifies the altar. That's why the blood had to be in Leviticus 16, on the Day of Atonement, the blood had to be sprinkled on various pieces. So, you know, if that's the altar, you put it on the horns. But before that, the blood was already sprinkled inside the sanctuary. So one didn't, you know, one still meant that the other one was necessary. The second piece of the question, the sins of the people would be, in fact, just be taken away here. They still have to be atoned for by every person individually. So the person who, you know, parked in the wrong spot would still have to bring the appropriate sacrifice for parking in the wrong spot. That they didn't get away with that. So in fact, sin always had this double dimension. I carry it personally, and the sanctuary is being defiled. Yes?
I understand the life-giving. I appreciate what you said about that. But blood stains.
Yeah. That's true. I'm still wondering about that. If you read the description of the priest's cloth, they're usually robed in white linen, and you would probably have seen the red spots, you know, pretty strongly. But it depends on how you identify things. I don't know how much we are aware of the fact that things are defined, you know, whether they are dirty or clean, by exactly where things are. You know, this is fruit juice here. If I drink it, it's clean. If I pour it on my pants, which I won't do for the moment, it would be considered dirty. So, you know, it's really a definition of where things are, and I think the same happens with blood. It depends on how we view things. Let's just take my French folks. You know, for me, a snail is kind of, you know, it's dirty. It's something I don't like. But the French, you know the French, they'd, you know, they'd eat them right away, poor snails. So you know, the same thing just looks very different to different people, depending on what your perception is, you know, what your cultural background is. If there are people who tell you all the time, well, this is yummy, you know, yummy, go for it, then you might eat snails and oysters and this kind of stuff. Nobody ever told me, and so I don't. You know, I eat muesli and cereal instead. And I think it's the same with blood. On the other hand, I think we can very well relate to the idea that blood is somehow life. Okay, I mean, some of us donate blood, actually with the very idea that we are somehow, you know, almost donating our life to somebody who might have been a victim of an accident and might need that life. Okay, so I think we can relate to that. But does blood always pollute? Interestingly enough, I'm teaching a course on this whole subject matter at the seminary, and I once had a native student in there, and she said that actually blood bleaches. It can be used for bleaching. And I was surprised about that. She said that at home where she's from, they had a board, and they would actually butcher animals there. And she reported to me that that thing became bleached over the time because of the blood spilling out. And that would actually really kind of, lighten the color of the wood there. I've never tested that myself, but, you know, maybe some of you are also from a farm and do some butchering, and you have experienced that yourselves. I haven't, so I'm just reporting to you what that native woman told me. Yes?
Does the tradition of the scapegoat come from
Judaism? The scapegoat is another ritual element which is tied to Leviticus 16, and that means to the Day of Atonement. There, first of all the sacrifices which I showed you, which are done, the blood is sprinkled, and then, as you just said, the text surprisingly says, and after the priest is done putting the blood on the altar, he goes to a second goat, which is, by the way, called a live goat, and he puts both his hands on the head of the goat and confesses all of the sins onto that goat. And then this goat is chased away, and it becomes the scapegoat, the famous scapegoat, which means the idea is really that all the sins then are on this goat and disappear with the goat into the wilderness. It's being chased out into the wilderness. What does this have to do? Didn't Chris just say that all of the sins actually disappear? Well, you need to understand that in the Tanakh, or Old Testament, or Hebrew Bible, sin is understood quite material, so it doesn't just evaporate. You can't do anything to make sin evaporate. Okay, that's why you can't just forgive sin. You have to actually put something on it. And now I have to tell you something. I have my personal theory exactly how the scapegoat works. I'll publish it shortly, hopefully, but That's my personal theory, and I'm not aware of any other scholar in the world who holds this. My theory goes like this. All the texts say, when you saw, you know, the priest dipping, that the priest has to do this with his hand, okay, with his finger, actually. Be'etz ba'o, with his finger. And I'm wondering why. Why don't they just say he does it anyway? Why with his finger? Because after reading a whole bunch of Old Testament texts, I've noticed that whatever happens is whoever gets in touch gets infected himself. That's important. So if the priest puts the blood there, it means actually this gets pure. But I then get infected with the disease, with the sin. In Exodus 29, there's a curious little note there. It's about the consecration of priests. And you can tell I just told you the few important pieces, because what I didn't tell you is that the priest is wearing a gold diadem on his forehead, according to Exodus 29, because he now bears all the sins and iniquity of Israel. How does it get to him? Well, I think it's because he's cleansing all this, but he's cleansing all of this at the expense of becoming contaminated himself. He can handle this because he's consecrated, but he's ultimately contaminated. And I'm developing the theory precisely to explain the scapegoat, because there's no other way. If all the sin had been taken care of, forever cancelled, how then could the high priest still, after doing all of this, go to the scapegoat, put the two hands on there, confess all the sins, and then they're being sent out? It just doesn't work. So either they're gone, or they're temporarily stored on the high priest, who then still ultimately needs to get rid of them, and that's what he's doing with the scapegoat. So that's my very personal theory of how the scapegoat works. I've presented that at a conference, and a Jewish scholar was excited about that. He said, you know, this finally explains to me how things work. But once again, there are many different ways of explaining things. The problem is with our Old Testament texts is that they do not offer a whole lot of explanations. As you can tell, there's lots of description. It works like this and like this and like this. But there's little explanation of the sort of, you know, this is what it means. This one text, Leviticus 17:11, on your handout, which says that blood is actually the life, and because it is life, it actually produces atonement, is one of the few explanations we find in the Hebrew Bible Old Testament. So we're just, you know, we'll forever, I guess, be guessing about the scapegoat. That's my own theory. It seems to fit. And as I said, I will publish it shortly, but hopefully it answers your question. Any other questions? Yes?
Back to the question of why does the Roman Catholic Church withhold the cup? I studied with the Catholics for a period of time. It's my understanding that because they saw the elements as being so sacred, that it was easy, like if a piece of the bread or the host fell, then you clean it up. But if the wine spilled,
Okay, that would make sense. Okay, that's an explanation. It's a pragmatic experience explanation, but it, you know, makes a certain amount of sense. Let me put it this way. I'm always uneasy when things get so holy that humans can't touch them anymore. That's something which I just don't like, because I think that's the tendency of the church all over. Did I say that this morning or in a private discussion? The temple, which I showed you, you know, at that time of Jesus, was not a place women could ever go to. Okay? I said it this morning at the breakfast table. I remember. But in 1 Samuel, chapter 1, we hear about the little boy of Samuel, how he was basically conceived because his mother was also barren. His mother was Hannah. And the text starts, I mean, 1 Samuel starts that she could still, at that time, go to the temple that stood in Shiloh and go up to the doorpost. Remember the story where she stands on the steps of the temple in the door, could probably look inside the temple and see maybe the cult statue, and there she said her prayer and complained bitterly that her husband had two wives. One of them produced many kids and she never had a single kid. Okay, she could actually go to the temple. And at the time of Jesus, there's a temple it's all beautiful, you know, much larger and lots of gold and marble and, you know, many priests out there beautifully dressed with all kinds of blood, you know, or ketchup around them. But at that time, half of the population and more actually are restricted. They can't go there any longer. So once again, you know, things become so holy and the church or the religious communities have a tendency to withhold things from people. So if we are rather concerned about, you know, some wine being spilled, I'd say, you know, let's rather think twice. I mean, this, you know, I don't care really about a few drops of wine on the floor. This might have happened once, maybe every 10 years, but therefore, are we really to withhold the cup? I mean, you know, half of the celebration of salvation, that's difficult, from the people. Interestingly enough, my brother once dropped the piece of bread, and that kind of became a thing. I mean, he was still told years after that he had done that. I also know that if that happens to a priest, supposedly he has to strip off all his clothes and has to lie flat on the floor, you know, because he has desecrated Jesus. Once again, I think the church shouldn't make things so sacrosanct that humans aren't able of handling them anymore. Especially, I don't think that Jesus did this with a simple meal he instituted. Jesus did not institute a very elaborate or difficult meal to fix. He didn't actually institute, you know, a 7-course thing. He actually did the simplest he could have done. There's a joke on there, you know, actually, why did the disciples and Jesus actually have, you know, the last meal just wine and bread? And the answer to it is, well, what should they have done since the women weren't around to cook for them? So it is really the most simple fashion of a meal. It's really the two basic element of, you know, the two basic staples of the two basic foods in the Palestinian society, bread and wine. There couldn't be anything more simple. And then who is the church actually to make it so elaborate and so proud, to so removed? Aren't we doing the same thing that Jesus protests again in the cleansing of the temple? Shouldn't it rather be a very simple celebration that is in the first place open to everybody? That would be my challenge to the church, knowing the tendencies of the church.
That was a comment I was going to make.
Okay.
It said at the very beginning of your slides, it said, Father, welcome.
Yeah.
Certainly in your presentation, you gave them indication that we should, that this meal or this table should be exclusive, but yet that's the practice.
Well, it is and it shouldn't. That's why I said, to combine some of the pieces here again, that's why I think from the Passover tradition, the commemoration is important. You know, there's a commemoration of liberation. So the Passover meal commemorated the liberation from the oppression of Israel in Egypt. And Jesus says now, basically, by doing a new Passover meal, I'm also giving you a story of liberation. And that's the liberation in there. And that liberation, as I said, has to be that which is expressed through the bread, can only be understood in connection to the life story of Jesus. And then we just need to look, okay, where does Jesus go? Well, he goes to, you know, he talks to women. By the way, according to the proper conduct, a man in Palestine is not supposed to talk to women. But Jesus does it. And he talks to all the other people, the tax collector, the sinner, I mean, a sinning woman, right? The adulterous woman. Jesus wasn't supposed to advocate for her because obviously she sinned. But Jesus does it anyway. And so it is a very open model of a society that is manifest in the Eucharist. Yes, another question. Yes?
A question about how the blood came to be associated with wine. You went through the ritual of the Passover. When they drank the 4 cups of wine,
yeah. Okay, I cannot tell you exactly what the Jews would have thought when they drank the cups, and I am not aware of any idea that they thought they were drinking blood. But I'm just in the middle of writing an article for an encyclopedia on blood in the ancient Near East and in the Old Testament, which is why I know that in all of the ancient Near East, which means in all the surrounding cultures of Israel, such as Assur, Babylonia, Ugarit, the Hittites too, blood was in fact always compared to wine, or wine could be called the blood of the grapes. So that went back and forth. So that's not something which Jesus invented. There's also a text in Isaiah, which I'm quoting that article, and I've forgotten that, but so also in Isaiah there's a text where the grapes are, grape juice is called the blood of wine. The blood of, yeah, of wine. And it's obviously because of the similar color, and maybe because it stains in a similar fashion. So maybe also because of the effect. So if we drink wine and we feel this, you know, the kind of sensation here in the stomach that the alcohol is producing. Now imagine you're living in a culture which doesn't know anything about chemics. Okay, today we know, you know, we can study it, and if there's somebody who is better in chemistry or chemics than I am, that person could probably explain to me how this is produced. But if you know nothing about this, you might just say, well, that's maybe the feeling of life. You know, it's a genuine reinforcement of life. And so there are these kind of pre-scientific explanations of how things work. Yes?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah, I mean, there are then certain differences and similarities. The question was, is there a difference? So we're still calling this an altar. And by the way, despite the fact that we don't sacrifice anything there any longer. But obviously the difference then is that back then people would have brought animals here. By the way, not only animals, you could also offer a pizza type of thing. So there was a cereal offering in the Old Testament. You could therefore bring these sacrifices, and today we're actually receiving something from this very place. So that's obviously a difference, right? I mean, so the dynamics are opposite. On the one hand, you bring something to God, and in the other way, we're actually receiving something at this very place. That is interesting. I would respond by saying that we're still doing, though, the one thing which you just described. We're still bringing the sacrifice to the altar. Have you ever thought about the collection? And just a question, is that still called the sacrifice in any of your churches? Because I know in Germany, where I'm from, that is called das Opfer. So the sacrifice, you collect the money, and curiously enough, that is the sacrifice. And what do we do with the baskets after the money is collected? Huh? Where does it go? It's being put on the altar. Okay, and I think that's still where that tradition is alive, that actually we do bring something and put it on the altar. By the way, let me just tell you that is the exact thing a sacrifice is about in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, animals are the account of the people. We're talking about a nomadic culture. Okay, and for these Bedouins, having a large herd is equivalent to somebody today having lots of money and investment and stuff, and somebody who has only two animals, he has a small account and maybe no account, okay? So that means if I am then, as a Bedouin, asked to bring an animal to the temple and sacrifice it there, it is the direct equivalent of us today, you know, taking some money off the pocket and putting it into the basket and having that come to the altar. So, I mean, once again, the symbolism is, I think, very consciously done, that we are gathering it and we are bringing it to the altar and putting it there. That's what Old Testament sacrifice is all about. So it's not, by the way, about killing. That's at the core of my doctorate, that I'm trying to convey to my scholarly colleagues, that sacrifice doesn't function through killing. And the key point in there is that there is this particular type of sacrifice, which is a mincha, and that's basically a pizza, or it's a pie. And it's just a sacrifice like a lamb or a goat. You know, it's no any different. I mean, besides the fact that the ritual is somewhat different, but it's just as valid a sacrifice as the other ones. And so that's, in a very small nutshell, my doctorate. Any other questions regarding sacrifice in the Old Testament, blood rituals? Eucharist, yes? Unfortunately, yes. Yes, and let me suggest that I think our church I think, has a genuine problem of understanding what consecration is about, or holiness is about. I don't want to quiz you today, but if I ask my students, you know, actually, what, you know, how do you get holy? What do most people say? Well, I get holy by, you know, doing good things and obeying to all the commandments and by trying really hard. I'm telling them, actually, you don't. You know, you're getting holy by going to the Eucharist and being consecrated through this. Oh, really? Nobody knows about that. It's because, you know, all of this context is unknown. It's because Jesus used a term, that evil Jesus, you know, which we don't understand any longer. It's because the sacrificial practice has stopped. And so we have basically lost the ability to understand that language in which it is brought to us. To come back to your question, yes, we have lost the sense of celebration. It's because we have lost the sense of consecration, that actually does something to us. Instead, I know that in some of the churches I attended, you're actually supposed to, you know, confess before, because you're supposed to be pure by the time you arrive. Okay, now exactly who then is in charge of my salvation? Is it Jesus who does something for me? Or is it once again me myself, you know, because I then have to think about all the sins I possibly committed and then try to pure myself? Then actually, what is the Eucharist about? Actually, the Eucharist once again becomes almost the opposite of it, right? And then there's usually a strong emphasis on enjoying these elements, or, you know, consuming these elements to your own judgment. And I find that not appropriate. I know that that's in 1 Corinthians 11, but it actually has a different meaning. It refers to, just to expand a little bit on that, consuming bread and wine for one's own judgment in 1 Corinthians 11 means that you're just doing it actually to be full. It means without ever recognizing or remembering the whole Jesus story. So it is a direct reference to the Passover component, which means there is a story to be remembered. If you're just going to church because you're hungry, then you better get lost. You know, this is supposed to be in connection with the sermon. So once again, if you ever wonder why we have sacraments and sermon, it is because the sacrament has to be linked to the Jesus story. Otherwise, it won't work. So hopefully this helps, but I mean, you know, it would have to be successfully conveyed to our church that the Eucharist is actually at the heart of a celebration. That's why we sing all around it. Okay? And it does something for us, rather that we would have to do something and basically appease God once more. No, God wants to be open for us.
Leviticus 17, it says that the people of Israel were not to drink, no, eat blood.
Yes. Eat blood already points to what it means, because Leviticus 17 is about several types of sacrifice and also about the one type of sacrifice about the one type of sacrifice of which you would eat the flesh, so you as the offerer. Okay, there are some types of sacrifice where you would just take the animal and burn it in its entirety on the altar. There are other types of sacrifice where you would only burn the fat portions and eat the flesh as the offer. That means a feast was following the sacrifice. By the way, both types of sacrifice were offered at Mount Sinai. In Exodus 24, that's the one text you had on your handout, the sacrifices that Israel sacrificed there were these two types. So there was one type of sacrifice. That's called Zevach Shelamim in Hebrew. It's usually translated as communion sacrifice or peace sacrifice. That's the type of sacrifice where the meat then would be taken and would be eaten. And that's a big celebration. So the Israelites took that flesh up on the Mount Sinai, and ate it there in front of God. Now, why not? And you're right, it's not about not drinking blood, but it's about not eating blood. It's because that blood represented the life, and this life belongs to God. God is the ultimate giver of life. And as such, it is not humans to have any command over this. All this life has to be returned to God in the first place. And that means with sacrifices as well. I mean, anyway, it's given to the altar. That's where God is. But also when you slaughter animals, or if you hunt and, you know, you shoot an animal, you also have to drain the animal. You have to drain the blood from the animal. In both cases, the blood then is supposed to be given to God, and that means it has to be poured out at the base of the altar. In the case of a hunt, you would, as I said, drain the blood and you would cover it with dirt. And that's actually what Leviticus 17 is all about. We studied verse 11, but then the verses just following are about game and draining the blood away. And once again, the rationale is that it's all that blood is life and it belongs to God. Okay, well.
Thank you very much, Christian. Yeah.